Hello.
Hello.
It's summer.
It is. It's like, I was telling Abby, I had my firefighter physical exam today, which is different from the physical test that I already passed, and different from all the other hoops that I've jumped through. But anywho, when I left this morning, I had on like shorts, like running shorts, because there's a part that happens on a treadmill, and like a sports bra and like a running tank. And then I also had a sweatshirt on over it because I'm like, it is like early April in Chicago, but I barely wore the sweatshirt all day. I've just been running around in shorts and a t-shirt like a maniac.
I got up to like 81 today.
This must be what people in like temperate climates experience. Like April is actually spring. It's weird though.
We said it got up to 81 and someone in Florida is like, why didn't you wear your sweater?
Yeah. It's weird though because like it's really nice out. Like I went for a bike ride, but the leaves are like just barely starting to come out on the trees. Mm-hmm. And so like you look out the window and it looks like winter, and then you walk out the door and it feels like summer, which is jarring.
Very strange. Leave it to Midwesterners to talk about the weather for 5 minutes. Hello everyone. Happy April.
Toot toot.
I had a great spring break, and now we're doing midterms, so hopefully I don't get too turnt up tonight, but no promises.
I cannot get turnt, because tomorrow I have to be up at the crack of dawn for
the ass crack of dawn.
For my first day. If you're listening to this, it's already been a week, because you're like, didn't she just say this, like, a week ago? Yes. Yeah. We are recording today, April 6th, and tomorrow, April 7th. Is my first day, in training as a firefighter. And I'm still kind of shitting bricks, but, like, whatever. There's only, right, like, I'm going to be new. Nobody's going to expect me to know how to do anything. It's literally training. It's fine. I will find out one way or another if this is what I really want to do with my life.
And if anyone gives you a hard time, I'm going to kick their asses, so.
That's also true.
That's it. That's all it is.
Yeah. It was definitely weird. I, like, don't have... It's weird to be, like, not have an email address for my job yet.
Oh.
I don't know if I'm going to have one.
I was
going to
say, will you have one?
I don't know. Do firefighters need to send emails?
I don't know.
Certainly not as many as I sent
Certainly.
In a day as a paralegal.
Oh, my gosh. I was like, I have nothing to talk about. That's a lie. That is a damn lie. Keep going with your email thing. I'm just going to wallow in my anger over here.
It was very weird to, like, send my last email as a... Because it's the only job I've ever done. Like, my very first job, my very first full-time grown-up job was I got hired as a temp administrative assistant. And then I worked my way up to paralegal. And then I jumped ship and worked for another firm as a paralegal. And now I'm something completely different. So it's very weird. It's not like I ever... like really wanted to be a paralegal, but it's just jarring to not do that anymore when that's the only profession I've ever had.
Yeah, that's understandable, but I think you're gonna do awesome, and I think you're gonna be great, and I think you're gonna like it.
Yeah, it was neat to close my laptop and be like, I don't just have to, my job isn't just like sending emails all day. That's amazing.
That's how I feel every summer.
I can be a person who exists outside of my email address.
The last time I'm closing my laptop for 3 months.
Bless.
Yes. All right. So here's what's new in my life, everybody. Not that you asked, but I'm going to tell you anyway. So I am in another grad class. If you recall, like a couple months ago, I was complaining about having to do this project where I basically experimented on my children. Sounds bad out of context, but that's essentially what it was. And I had to collect data and like reflect on the data. And it was like, it had to be done in like 2 weeks. And I'm like, this is not how experiments are done, but okay. So now I'm in a new class and I have another dumb project to do. And it is a cognate tree.
Yes, I remember this.
And if you're not sure what a cognate is, let me tell you. A cognate is a word that looks like or sounds like the word in this case, English. So in Spanish, it might be a word like inteligente is intelligent. Or like, I don't know, fucking, there's a million of them. Anyway.
I know, now that I'm like trying to think of cognates, my brain is completely empty.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, fuck.
I suppose, like, amable and amiable?
Yeah, simpático and, like, sympathetic or nice. Like, all these, you know, words that are, like, cognates. Like, rata means rat, like shit like that. Anyway,
limon.
Yeah, well, that one's confusing because it could be lime, it could be lemon. Anyway, well,
citrus taxonomy is weird. That's it's very a whole other episode.
We don't have time. But anyway, so for this grad school class, the professor originally wanted people that were still like teaching in the building to build like a bulletin board of a tree and then write cognates on leaves and have a cognate tree. Now, the whole point of a fucking cognate is that you know what it is when you see it. You don't have to like display it on a bulletin board because when you see it, you know, carro means car. Like, or troca means truck. Like, you know.
Or limonada means lemonade. Yeah. That's a better one.
Or sandwich means sandwich. There we go. And so she was like, and so I emailed her and I was like, explaining my situation. I was like, hey, you know, they just voted on the fact that we're not returning into the building at all this year. We're 100% virtual. We've been virtual all year. Like, what should I do about this project? Like, can I make a digital version and just put it on like my class website, or do I have to do some redecorating in my apartment? That's literally what I said, because I was like snarky and I was like, we are in fucking grad school. I teach high schoolers. Like, this is a dumb project for people to do. This is a very stupid. Anyway, I hope no one is listening from my grad school program. They're not going to give me my diploma, but I'm entitled to my correct opinion. And so she was like, oh, yeah, I guess I, she was like, oh, yeah, you know, I have to put out different directions for people that are, you know, in situations like yours because of COVID. And I haven't done that yet, but thank you for reminding me. You can absolutely make a digital copy. Or you can do, like, the other version is basically just a hypothetical version. Like, how would you implement this project in your classroom? And I was like, okay, cool. Like, obviously, I'm going to do the hypothetical because it's less work than actually making a digital cognate tree. And I think this whole project is really dumb. So then I had a really good idea. And I was like, it's Arab American History Month this month. And I was like, I have a bunch of students that speak Arabic, and there are a bunch of cognates between Spanish and Arabic.
There we go.
So what if I made a cognate tree that was Spanish and Arabic? My professor did not like that idea.
Are you serious? Like, what? I'm sorry, but what is this class supposed to be teaching you? Because that seems like a great way to connect with your students who already speak another language at home, but it's not English or Spanish.
It's methods of bilingual education.
See, these kids are trilingual and that's too complicated for
them. I know, I'm like, but that would be so cool. Like,
that would be cool.
It's camisa in Arabic, it's camisa in Spanish, like, it's guitarra in Spanish and it's guitar in Arabic. Like, I just think that would be a really cool community builder, especially this month, because the project is due at the end of this month, which is Arab History Month. She was like, well, do you speak Arabic? And I was like, well, no, but like, I'm sure one of my students could write it in Arabic and then also write like the phonetic pronunciation. And I think that would be a really cool learning experience for all my students. And she was like, I still don't think it's a good idea.
Also, it teaches them about the history of the Spanish language. Yeah. Because the reason that there are so many cognates is because of like the influence of Arabic, like the language and the culture and architecture
in Spain.
Yeah,
I know. You don't have to tell me that.
I know.
I was like, wow, I finally figured out a way to tweak this project to make it kind of useful and like kind of interesting and kind of fun and cool. And no.
That's so annoying.
So that's what I'm annoyed about. I'm also annoyed about an email from a student that said they were surprised that I was going to check my email.
Yeah, that one was silly.
They emailed me. I don't want to give too many details because I don't want any of this to come back and bite me in the butt. Essentially, they emailed me the day or two before spring break asking about turning in late work. And I emailed them a response of like, how to do that. And one of the assignments had a timeline on it, because I was like, we're not going to play this game. I've given you two. This is the second deadline I've given you on this assignment. Third, actually, because the original. And then they were like, oh, can I make it up? And I gave them a new one. And then they were like, oh, I forgot. Can you give me another one? So I'm like, we're not going to play this game. So you have until X date, X o'clock to do it. And they emailed me back and they're like, oh, so I did one of them, but I didn't do the other because it was locked. And frankly, I didn't expect you to reply to my email. Yes, that's often what I think about when I send someone an email, that they're not going to respond to it.
Right, like, then why would you even send
you email me?
The email if you don't think you're going to get...
I was like, if you're expecting me to check my email, why wouldn't you check your email? Like, I think that's a fair trade-off, that we both check our email.
That's kind of how this works.
That's how it has to work now in a Panini, Panera Express, Panera Bread, whatever you want to call it. Oh, God.
The Ponder Replay.
Ponder Replay is probably that's my the best favorite one. All right. So now that I've done the things Abby needs to whine about, Tuesday edition... Are you ready to go?
Yes.
Okay, let's do this.
I'm Ellie.
And this is the Queers for Fears podcast. The podcast where two queer women discuss the things that scare them about the world, whether they're based in reality or the paranormal. What are we talking about today, Ellie?
Today we are talking about real vampires.
Oh.
We've already talked about fictional vampire. Well, we talked about Dracula in our, I think that might have been a Patreon episode, the Monster Mash one.
We talked about one vampire.
The vampire.
Yeah. Before we dive in that, sure.
Dive all up in those vampires.
Really love your blood cells, wanna shake your veins. Nope, that don't work.
Vampacy.
I just had to say it.
Fuck off.
Okay, so before we get going, I just want to say about the Patreon. Plug the Patreon. My goal is to have 15 before summer vacation starts for us, and that is June 25th, and Ellie does not think it's possible, so please prove her wrong, because part of me just really enjoys doing that. Sorry, Ellie.
Fair.
We love creating free content for you, but it does cost us money for editing, research, creating a website, getting our podcast out there, etc., equipment, all that stuff. So there are four tiers. Our lowest one is the $1 a month tier. So for 12 cash money buck dollars a year, you can support us. I told you it was going to happen. And you get one bonus episode a month. The next level is our $3 tier, which gives you two bonus episodes, a shout out on the show, access to the Discord, a sticker. One more could you possibly want? Oh, yeah. At this level, we also create a spooky location episode about your specific city or state or country, whatever you feel like disclosing to us. We're basically strangers on the internet for many of you, so I understand if you're not like...
If you don't want to be like this particular neighborhood.
This address.
Yeah.
Actually, tell me the history of my home. Yeah.
But we could do that.
I mean, we could if you... I mean,
do you trust us?
Anyway.
What's the worst we're going to do? Send you a fucking sticker?
Probably. The next level is our five cash money buck dollar tier. And it comes with everything I've already mentioned, plus a monthly bonus video. Damn it. Allergies. Plus a monthly bonus video of us doing silly things. The first one that's coming out in April is going to be the Not So Newly Friends game. That's what I've decided to call it.
Clever. Love it. Dig it.
It's better than Oldie Friends. I don't know. The Not So Newly Friends game.
Oldie Friends sounds like a knockoff OnlyFans.
That would be like Bumble BFF.
Yes.
Where actually it's just lesbians trying to get in your pants, which it's like, well, fine, I guess. But not everyone wants that, and they're wrong. Anyway. And then finally, our 10 cash money back dollar tier, aka the true crime bruff tier, gives you everything that we've chatted about, plus a discount on future merch, which is in the works, and ad-free episodes. Pew, 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 pew. Ad-free. Pew, 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 pew. Anyway.
But not mouth air horns free. Very sorry.
You'll also get a personalized thank you from us. And at the $10 level, we're very cheap, $5 a piece. And you get to, well, $5 for each of us. You get to pick a topic for a regular scheduled episode, which is a pretty great deal. If any of these perks sound interesting to you, make sure that you check us out on patreon.com/queersforfearspodcast. The link is also in the show notes. Nailed it. Also, still looking for a true crime bruff goat sticker. If you don't know what I'm talking about, listen to the Invisible Man movie. So, thank you so much. Okay. All right, Ellie, I'm here to chew bubblegum and crack jokes, and I'm all out of bubblegum. Let's go.
All right. So, as I mentioned, this episode is about real vampires. And I was telling Jack about this, and he was like, what do you mean, real vampires?
Yeah.
And I was like, people who consume blood or psychic energy for sustenance. And Jack was like,
psychic energy sounds like something my ex lived off of. 100%.
Jack was like, basically, he was like, so weirdos. And I was like, listen, he's like, those aren't vampires. Those are people who think that they need blood and psychic energy. He was like, what is psychic energy really? And we got into kind of an interesting back and forth because I found myself weirdly in the Mulder position. Well, no, I like to think I was somewhere in between.
There is an X-Files episode about this.
Yes, it? I mention it.
Of course you do.
Yeah.
No one is surprised.
Season 2,
everyone cross it out 7. On your Queers for Fears bingo card. Ellie has mentioned reference. X-Files.
But yeah, I was like, I was kind of taking the middle ground, which is like, you know, he's like, psychic energy isn't real. And I was like, well, what would you call like the energy of a crowd? Or like, you know, how introverts say that they recharge their batteries by being alone and extroverts say that they recharge their batteries by being around other people. Well, the way extroverts recharge their batteries, what would you say that they're charging it with? It's basically psychic energy. And he's like, but it's not energy in the sense that it doesn't do work. And I'm like, no, my high school physics teacher would not have considered it energy. But I feel like the idea of like feeding off of psychic energy is kind of a real thing. Like we talk about people doing that outside of a vampiric context. Anyway, I'm going to get into sort of like, are these people just nuts at the very end of my notes? But by real vampires, I mean people who believe that they are vampires and who consume blood and psychic energy for sustenance.
Okay. Is that the only thing they consume?
No.
Okay. Then it's okay.
So my...
I'm gonna let you finish.
My chief sources are John Edgar Browning, who has done a lot of... He's done like a lot of literature reviews. He's done a lot of work. He's done a lot of work on like vampire and zombie, like pop culture, like film, literature. And he's also done field work with real life vampires, especially in New Orleans and in Buffalo, actually. So
nobody's surprised that there are some of these people in New Orleans.
Exactly. So he has a huge body of work. If you just go to his like academia.edu like page or whatever.
I know. She signed up for academia.edu and I was like, oh, okay.
He's done a lot of field work on it and he's like read absolutely everything that there is to read about modern vampires, it seems. Okay.
Is he a modern vampire?
No.
Oh.
In fact, he is afraid of needles and having his skin broken. Right? It's a
that
choice.
Seems like a really twisted joke slash way of getting over your phobia, but all right.
I also touch on the work of DJ Williams, who is a sociology prof at Idaho State who studies like healthcare outcomes and healthcare reluctance among vampires.
I probably shouldn't have done that for someone with a doctorate degree, but
Dr. DJ Williams. Yeah. And
I don't think we have any Idaho listeners, so.
And Murdicus of the Atlanta Vampire Alliance.
Is that is their Christian?
That is what Murdicus goes by.
Is that an M-U or an M-E?
M-E. M-E-R-T-I-C-U-S.
Okay.
He's like contemplating, like, we good? We've digested this.
I don't want to make fun of a name. That seems mean. But also.
So... Browning has also, as part of his studies into real vampires and their history and vampire representation in film and literature, put together a little early history of the study of vampires and the vampire community. Now, I was expecting it to be a thing where, like, right, the Victorians were all kind of goth and obsessed with death and, like, the novel Dracula and all that, and right, I was thinking this was going to be a pretty old thing of, like, people throughout history thinking that they're vampires.
Sure.
But he traces the modern vampire community actually no further than, like, the 60s or 70s. So the earliest example that he cites is the Count Dracula fan club, founded in 1965 by Gene Keyes Youngson, and it was genuinely originally a fan club for Dracula and Dracula media, like adaptations and stuff.
Did they LARP?
That's the thing, is Gene started getting letters from fans who also identified as real vampires in the early 1970s. And Gene was an open-minded individual, and in 1974 expanded the group's focus to include vampirism.
That is a very 60s or 70s vibe.
Right?
Yeah.
Browning credits the rise of fan conventions, including for S&M and blood fetishism and dark shadows in particular, plus goth clubs, and this is where season 2, episode 7 of The X-Files comes in, is Mulder is investigating these killings that seem to be, like, pretty ritualistic, and he goes to a goth club and, like, finds people who identify as vampires, and even Mulder doesn't believe that vampires are real, and then it turns out that at least these three vampires are real and, like, are threatening the life of him and of also this lady who's, like, their thrall, essentially, who is trying to get away from them. But Browning credits the rise of fan conventions and goth clubs and pagan groups in the 70s to the creation of a more coherent vampire community.
Don't blame us, blame Comic-Con.
He also cites Stephen Kaplan, a paranormal investigator who founded the Vampire Research Center around the same time and even started a vampire hotline for vampires to call in and, like, talk to him about what the heck was going on with them.
Where is the Vampire Research Center?
That's a good question.
Asking for a friend. Or maybe someone listening that needs that in their life.
Stephen Kaplan died in 1995, so maybe R.I.P. nowhere. Also in 1977, Martin V. Ricardo founded the Vampire Studies Society and the quarterly journal, Journal of Vampirism. And in 1978, the Vampire Information Exchange was founded and was converted into an e-newsletter in the mid-2000s. And in the 1980s, a whole bunch of academics, including ethnographers, folklorists, journalists, and criminologists, started taking an interest in vampires and also in people who, like, got off on bloodletting. So there was more community growth throughout the 1990s, mostly through small local groups with zines or cons. Then, of course, the motherfucking 90s. So he actually credits, I was telling Craig about this, and he was like, wow, I would not have expected Vampire the Masquerade, the 1991 tabletop role-playing game, which Browning describes as essentially Dungeons and Dragons with vampires. Browning says that this game, quote, provided a lexicon of terms, protocols, and identifiers that the real vampire community could adopt for its own needs, end quote. He also credits the rise of, like, vampire media, like, being popularly consumed. So, like, in 1994, Interview with the Vampire was turned into a movie. So those cons drew even bigger numbers of real-life vampires than the Dark Shadows cons had in the 70s.
All right.
And, of course, our good friend and ideological enemy, Al Gore's internet. So now groups like the New Orleans Vampire Association, the Atlanta Vampire Alliance, and Sanguinarius, who I'll come back to in a second, could have a web presence and disseminate information both for participants in the vampire community and the general public.
I definitely thought you were going to say Sir Arthur Conan Doyle for a second, and I was like, but you said!
No, just our friend the internet. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's interesting, like, a lot of these groups do, in addition to, like, being vampire houses / covens, also do, like, public outreach. So the New Orleans Vampire Association, or NOVA, their website currently advertises Browning's work on them, a NOVA meet and greet brunch, and the NOVA homeless outreach program. So every Easter, Christmas, and Thanksgiving, ever since Hurricane Katrina, they bring meals to New Orleans' homeless people.
What kind of meals?
Regular meals.
Okay. I needed to clarify. I think that was a fair question, given the topic, ma'am.
Regular human food.
Regular ass mashed potatoes, turkey, and gravy. Got it.
So Browning quotes from an interview that he conducted with a vampire who goes by Mef, which is short, of course, for Mephistopheles.
Why so, do I know? That is another Greek. Sorry, I'm getting another cider. Abby drinking on the podcast?
Yeah, Mephistopheles is like...
Is that the owl? No, that's not Merlin's owl.
He is a like a Faustian demon.
Oh, that's right. Where does he... We've talked about him before, I thought.
Maybe we've talked about...
We've been doing Baphomet. This for so long. Every time I listen to a podcast and I'm like, have we talked about this before? I'm like, yes, yes, you have. But it's only because I've been like binge listening to their episodes. But for them, it's been like 2 years. So I'm always like, how do you forget what you're talking about? This is how we forget.
So the interview with Meph is interesting because Meph appears to be like a pretty stereotypical, like what you would expect a person who calls themselves a vampire to be like. So Meph uses a blade to collect about a shot glass's worth of blood, cleans the wound, and then feeds from the container of blood. He doesn't drink directly from the wound because he says it's harder to control the blood flow. And when Browning does say that, like, a lot of these vampires have day jobs, Meph says that he's nocturnal. Quote, sunlight makes me ill. I do not burst into flames, crumble into dust, or sparkle in the sunlight. The light just makes me nauseous, and it makes me weak. Overexposure will cause me to blister terribly. Same. And if I were foolish enough to stay out, it very well could kill me. End quote. He says he's tried to see a doctor about it. He was told he was anemic and given a prescription for it that made him feel worse.
I'm not a medical professional. It's fine.
Meph says that he tends to encounter donors with a medical background and says that some take sexual satisfaction from being fed upon. And basically he compensates them with that like sexual gratification of being like enthrall to a vampire. Meph says that when he was young, he had naturally large canines that he says were removed against his will. And so he wears prosthetic fangs for a few hours a day to compensate for TMJ and other issues he faces from not having fangs in his mouth. He says that after his canines were removed, his curiosity about drinking blood turned into a biological imperative. And he says that he would be so weak and he wouldn't feel better until his parents put a steak in a blender for him. And his godmother, who he says was like very intuitive and kind of open-minded, suggested that his parents add more blood to the steak shakes. And that also made him feel better.
Sounds like he just needs iron.
So
I know I'm not a medical professional, but
it kind of does. It's interesting. A lot, actually, quite a few vampires report that they have been diagnosed with anemia.
Mm-hmm.
But this interview with Meph is interesting because it's like not actually like, although it sounds very vampire-y, it's not actually very typical of all of like most of the vampire. Like Meph uses a cane and it's like a replica of a cane from Dark Shadows, like very all on brand. But Browning says that vampires come from all walks of life, religions. Some are polytheistic, some are monotheistic, including Christians, some are atheists. All genders and sexualities. Most of the ones he encountered are age 18 to 50. Some are married, some have kids. There was one woman that he encountered who was hiding her vampirism from her husband. She had like just told him like a little bit about like what she did as a vampire and he had reacted really negatively, and so she was like hiding it from him.
That's not good.
And she was also hiding it more generally because she was in a custody battle with her ex, I guess, over her daughter.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So some vampires, but not all, add fashion or prop signifiers like fangs, but not usually as a part of everyday life. He draws a comparison to queer fashion, which I was like, I don't know how I feel about that until I found out that Dan Browning himself is gay. So I was like, okay, so this is kind of the one like parallel from your own life that you can draw.
I need to up my own game on my fashion sense as I sit here in a basketball t-shirt I got shorts. For free in basketball shorts.
Yeah, so I sit here in my space camp t-shirt and my space camp shorts.
Oh, they match.
He says they actually don't match. Well, because the t-shirt is from like the gift shop it's brown and the shorts are from like actually being at space camp. But yeah, I've got a whole theme going I didn't realize until just now. But as Browning puts it, quote, just as same-sex desire is distinct from the sociocultural practices of the gay community, so being a vampire is first a bodily need, then a set of personal and social practices for expressing it, end quote. Browning says that most vampires he met added, like, kind of goth or vampire-y trappings long after realizing that they were vampires. Most also did not consume a lot of vampire media or didn't necessarily know a lot of vampire lore or like know more about vampire literature than the average person. As Browning put it, at first he thought he was going to encounter just a bunch of weirdos who had read too many Anne Rice novels, but he found that that wasn't the case, that they're not any more steeped in like vampire lit than anybody else. He says that the vampires he studied like don't, you know, because Jack was like, so do these you know, like vampires like live forever and stuff. Like, what are these? And I was like, no, these people eat food and they don't believe that they're going to live forever. Most of them don't sleep in coffins.
Most of them.
So New Orleans, of course, has a very, he also compares and contrasts his New Orleans vampires with his Buffalo vampires. So like, okay. New Orleans obviously has a strong, like, spooky culture, counterculture to it. So, New Orleans has some big houses and covens with the occasional, oh boy, this is also, an X-Files thing. If you remember the, what was the episode called? I think it was The Pusher.
I need you to give me more than, oh, what is the episode called?
I think it was called Pusher, and it's about this guy who can, like, push people to do things that he wants them to do. Pusher. That guy was creepy. One of the clues that he left for Mulder was in this magazine called Ronin Magazine. And I forget what Ronin meant in the context of this magazine in this episode, but a Ronin was essentially like a samurai without a mentor or a master of any kind.
Update. Yes, it is called Pusher and it is season 3, episode 17.
Yeah. So I thought it was interesting that I got another like X-Files reference in here. So vampires who don't belong to a coven or a house are often known as Ronin. So New Orleans is mostly big houses and covens with the odd Ronin. Conversely, in Buffalo, at the time that he did his field work, I think this was in like 2011 to 2013, almost everyone was a Ronin because there weren't any big houses or covens in the Buffalo area at the time. But the Buffalo vampires seem to be more in tune than the New Orleans vampires to like world vampire goings on, which kind of makes sense. Like, if you're, again, like a parallel to being LGBT, if you're a queer person in a small town, you don't have a lot of like local queer culture to know about. And so you probably know what's going on in the wider queer world. Whereas like, I know a lot about like, you know, Chicago drag queens mm-hmm. and like Chicago queer events, but I don't often pay attention to like what else is going on in the US from an LGBT perspective. So he kind of found that with the New Orleans versus Buffalo vampires as well. New Orleans vampires are way bigger on Halloween. Quote, vampire organizations like the one I shadowed in New Orleans, fangsmiths who construct prosthetic fangs for vampires, vampire event performers, and individual members and houses of the vampire community all converge on large cities like New York, New Orleans, and Atlanta, and in cities across the world to participate in ceremonies and take part in celebration and fellowship. This is especially true for New Orleans, which plays host to some of the largest vampire events in the country, end quote. So not only is it a big time for a community, but it's also a very lucrative time. And so, like, that's the time of year when these organizations can often like make their money that they use to keep their coven going or to do like charity outreach and stuff. So there are a couple different kinds of vampires. As I mentioned, there are those that feed on blood and those that feed on psychic energy. And there are also people who feed on both. Ones who feed on blood are often known as sanguinarians. And then, of course, there are psychic vampires. I recently watched What We Do in the Shadows, the TV show and the movie. And I fucking... So... And What We Do in the Shadows, there's like one major character who's a psychic vampire and his name is Colin Robinson. And he's just like the most like beige milquetoast white guy working in an office. Like one time they do like 23andMe and Colin Robinson's just comes back as 100% white. Like that's all. It's no more specific than that. And Colin Robinson like works at a desk job and he feeds by just like boring the absolute Christ out of his coworkers and anybody who comes across him essentially. And like that's how he drains them of their energy, which I thought that was as soon as I read Psychic Vampires, I was like, Colin Robinson, slightly different. So as I mentioned, unlike the vampires and What We Do in the Shadows, and in What We Do in the Shadows, if the vampires eat or drink human food, they like vomit copiously, like cartoonish yeah. projectile vomiting. But real life vampires also eat and drink quote unquote real food and drinks, but after consuming blood or energy, they feel better or more replenished than after just regular food and drink alone. Vampires still say that blood tastes metallic and coppery, like it doesn't taste like really good just because they're a vampire. But they also claim that diet, hydration, and blood type can create differences from person to person in what their blood tastes like.
Actually, that's true, because that's why mosquitoes like me.
Huh.
Because they're sweeter. They came out with a study, I think, that was like certain blood types are sweeter and therefore more attractive to mosquitoes.
Weird.
Yeah, I'm super sweet, as it turns out. No one's surprised.
John Edgar Browning did actually eventually consent to let a vampire feed on him. And the first person who fed on him actually said that his blood was not quite metallic enough for his taste.
Quite literally for science.
Yep. He was really just, truly like, for science.
For science.
So how do they do these blood feedings? Some do actually, like, put their mouth to people's wounds, which freaks me out. That... Like, They brush their teeth and use mouthwash. And also, vampires and donors, like, get tested for bloodborne illnesses and stuff. But that would still creep me out. But as Browning says, quote, some vampires use sterile, single-use thermoplastic medical tubing to extrude blood into small receptacles for drinking on the spot or for later storage. Others may use sterile blades to make small incisions on the donor and drink directly from the wound before cleaning and bandaging it, end quote. Some vampires who store it for later also add sodium heparin, which is an edible anticoagulant to keep the blood fresh, or they mix it into tea. Psychic feeding can be done, as he puts it, quote, contact feeding through physically touching the donor, ambient feeding by taking excess energy that is naturally generated in high traffic public places, or even tantric feeding through sexual encounters. And there was this couple.
Oh, no. Here we go. Buckle in.
Named Cerevis and Shyla, and they were tantric feeders. And Cerevis was 36 and Shyla was 19.
I don't like that.
I didn't like that at all. I was like, okay, great. This guy, truly twice your age, like, got you into this, like, vampire sex thing. And you were, excuse me. No, I'm not calling 911. You were how old when he started getting you into the, I don't know. That one, I just didn't like that. Anywho. Sanguinarius.org, which is a vampire website that has been up and running since 1997, has a donor bill of rights posted. Donors are often friends, lovers, family, or roommates, but they can also be part of vampire donor networks.
Oh my god, they were roommates. Every time.
So as I mentioned, donors and vampires get tested for what?
Do they let gay people donate them blood to eat?
Far as I know, in fact, a lot of vampires themselves are also queer.
Okay, because, like, that's, like, a whole thing with blood donation in this fucking country.
Yeah, donors and vampires get tested for bloodborne illnesses before joining in a vampire-donor partnership, although many vampires are apparently wary of disclosing their condition to doctors.
Absolutely, yeah.
One interviewed by DJ Williams feared that her kids would be taken away if she told doctors that she was a vampire. The Donor Bill of Rights emphasizes that consent can be withdrawn at any time, even during a feeding, and that donors' wounds should be allowed to heal between feedings. It says, quote, as a donor to a vampiric individual, I have the right to know that my position as lover, friend, family, roommate should not be jeopardized by my not wanting to give of my essence.
Yeah.
Wait, I mean, so I was like,
consent is important.
Consent, right, and also, like, not conditioning someone's continued relationship with you on them wanting to be a donor. I was like, oh, very forward thinking. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the Donor Bill of Rights, it says, quote, ultimately, it is our, both the donor and the vampire, responsibility to ensure that we are not abused. It is our, both the donor and the vampire, personal responsibility to leave a vampire-donor relationship that we feel is abusive in any nature. We cannot be abused unless we allow ourselves to be.
They were doing so well.
I know.
They were
doing, like,
really well. And then
right up there, you say that, like, my, like, status as roommate or lover or friend or whatever mm-hmm. should not be conditioned on my being a donor. Like, what if you're a donor living with a vampire, your roommates, and the vampire pays most of the rent and then says, like, well, I'm just not gonna, like, pay the rent unless you, right? Like, it would be so easy to manipulate someone. And, like, this whole Bill of Rights is about, like, here are the ways in which we shouldn't manipulate each other. And then it's like, nobody can manipulate you unless you want to be manipulated. And it's like, then why do we have this at all? That's very stupid.
Literally, vampire lore is that you manipulate people to do things that they don't want to do also. In some sort of weird, twisted irony.
Very, yeah. It's like, oh no.
They were doing so well.
I know.
God damn it.
The Bill of Rights also applies to psychic vampires who are not supposed to feed without consent. There are also frowned upon vampire lifestylers, Sanguinarius. So some people spell vampire with an I, some people spell it with a Y. Sanguinarius spells lifestyler vampires with a Y and, like, real vampires with an I. And vampire lifestylers are just kind of like goths who wear fake fangs and they don't actually experience an actual need to feed. So a lot of these places are like, you know, lifestylers, you're cute, but stay out. Vampires, though, believe that they experience a biological need to feed on blood or psychic energy. So in most of Browning's research subjects, the biological imperative to feed on blood or psychic energy appeared around puberty. Feedings might be weekly, monthly, or even daily. And without feeding, they can become weak and experience, quote, physical and emotional symptoms, end quote, of withdrawal, including fatigue, headaches, stomach aches, cramps, or irritable bowel. So one vampire named Kinesia, who spoke to the BBC, said, quote, I would go more than a week without a bowel movement while, quote unquote, hungry and feel nausea if I ate anything other than my cure food. After finally feeding, she says, quote, I felt 100% better. My mental faculties were sharpened. I can eat whatever I want without running to the bathroom. There's no joint or muscle pain. This tends to last about 2 weeks, depending on how much is taken and how often it is taken.
I can't imagine not pooping for a whole week.
Oh, God. She says, for me, one scary moment was when I was admitted to the ER for having a low heart rate that would jump up to 160 when I stood up or walked around, followed by a massive migraine and often losing consciousness. Basically, my heart was working extra hard to keep everything functioning, a reaction, I believe, to about 4 months without feeding. So Tomas Gans of UCLA's Molecular Biology Institute says, quote, there is likely a strong placebo effect akin to ingesting bitter powders, brightly colored liquids, or other substances that do not look or taste like conventional foods.
Mm-hmm.
This effect can be further enhanced if there is a ritual component associated with the ingestion and if the individual feels a sense of some kind of exclusivity, such as drinking a very expensive and rare wine. Combined with the fact that blood is highly nutritious and a natural laxative, he thinks this may be why it offers some temporary relief for both the digestive and mental difficulties. There's also, according to this BBC article, this was not part of Browning's work, a subgroup of people who prefer the term medical sanguinarian, who don't identify as vampires but still believe they need to consume blood to survive. Which, if I'm being super judgy, sounds kind of like not like other vampires type stuff, but whatever. None of my biz.
I mean, as long as you're not hurting anyone, I guess.
Right. What do vampires do besides drink blood and psychic energy? They socialize with other vampires in these houses and covens. They also...
I was hoping you'd say watch Twilight. I'm just kidding.
They also learn from community elders on how to feed and how to cope with their condition. And philanthropy. One meeting Browning attended had, quote, the procurement of a crisis shelter for homeless LGBT people and pagans on the agenda. And, of course, they do their Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Easter meals for the homeless. So... Huh.
All right. Well, thanks for helping out the people that need help.
The Atlanta Vampire Alliance's leader, Merticus, spearheaded a research study of 950 vampires from around the world. The AVA estimates that there are 15,000 vampires in the U.S. alone, about two-thirds psychic vampires and about one-third sanguinarians. DJ Williams believes that there are vampire communities in major cities all over the world. So the study that Ava undertook... 72% of vampires surveyed were white adults, only 55% were straight, and 63% were women. Only 35% of them identified as goth, and only 24% of them belonged to a house or a coven. About 52% of them were sanguinarians, about two-thirds of them were psychic vampires, and about 40% of them were hybrids. Interestingly, 79% believed that they had had past lives, and 72% believed that they had heightened senses.
Okay.
Mental health. So this was like, right, Jack is like, these people just need help. Well, 31% of them did report that they had clinical depression, but almost none of them had a history of violence or substance abuse or any other kind of like red flags for like trauma or needing some kind of psychiatric intervention. About 17% of them were anemic and 20% suffered from chronic fatigue. Only 8% said that they would permanently stop being vampires if given the chance. I think this could be sampling error because, like, these are only people who are willing to, like, who are in touch with this coven and willing to respond to this survey.
Right.
Dave Robson's interviewees lean, this was a BBC article. Dave Robson's interviewees lean towards willingness or slash interest in an alternative. Some believe that it's a digestive issue. So one of Robson's interviewees, what is a medical sanguinarian who goes by CJ, like she's like, people call me a vampire. I just have to drink blood and I'm not wild about it, basically. She thinks that it's a digestive issue, that her body can only absorb nutrients if they've already been dissolved in someone else's blood. One medical sanguinarian interviewed by Robson conceded that her condition could be psychosomatic. But she just, like, hasn't found an alternative.
Cure, yeah.
Some psychiatrists, like Stephen Schlossman from Harvard, say that especially if the vampire appeared distressed by their vampirism, as a practitioner, he would first assess them for psychosis since it's so outside the norm. But DJ Williams' take and that of Joseph Laycock, also a seminal vampirism researcher from the Religious Studies Department at Texas State, is a little more open-minded. He says, quote, it is important for helping professionals such as social workers to remember that people with vampire identities are just that, people. They have common issues like those with mainstream identities and are fearful that clinicians will label them as being psychopathological in some way, i.e. delusional, immature, unstable, perhaps wicked, and not competent to perform in typical social roles such as parenting. Real vampires seem to be ordinary human beings with common everyday human issues, such as trying to be successful in relationships and careers, managing stress, coping with daily living tasks, and adjustments to transitions, to name a few. Social workers and helping professionals should learn more about alternative identities and communities, listen and learn from clients, strive to become more aware of our own potential biases and stereotypes, and interrogate and challenge common social discourses that pathologize and demonize. By doing so, social workers can establish trust with clients who have alternative identities and belief systems, provide services to a more diverse clientele, and establish strong alliances that contribute to effective service. End quote. And this is kind of where I'm coming from with this, like, I don't know, like, does it really matter if this person believes they're a vampire or not? Like, you still have to provide them with competent care and, like, mm-hmm. address their issues and take them seriously. Mm-hmm. Or at the very least, you have to believe that they believe and you have to, like, take them seriously on that level, even if you don't agree that they medically need to consume blood or psychic energy or whatever. And it's, I don't know, this is kind of what I wrote my capstone project about, is like, you have to be, like, you have to be culturally competent. You have to listen to your patients and what they believe is the problem, like, whether or not that's in the DSM or Grey's Anatomy or whatever.
Right.
Like, especially because if only, like, right, even if not on, like, a humane, like, this is the kind of dignity and respect you should afford another human being level, even on a practical level, like, if you treat someone in a way that you clearly didn't listen to what they think the problem is or what they think the solution might be, they're probably not going to listen to you, mm-hmm. and you're not going to get the clinical outcomes you want.
Fair.
So this one psychologist, Dr. Jolene Opofsky, talked about, she had a 36-year-old vampire come in. He said that he shared blood between five other dudes who also considered themselves to be vampires. But after he got engaged, he entered psychotherapy because he wanted to stop being a vampire. So he eventually started consuming his own blood, and then he apparently eventually stopped drinking blood altogether after 2 months of cognitive behavioral therapy. And so, like, this therapist took him seriously and was like, okay, how can we kind of, like, you know, take steps down from where you're at now? And her cultural competence around vampires and real life vampirism is why this guy was successful in his treatment and got the outcomes he wanted.
Okay. Makes sense to me.
Right.
In any, you know, illness or condition.
Right.
Yeah.
So those are my modern vampires of the city, chiefly New Orleans and Buffalo.
A lot,
right? It was interesting to research. I stumbled across this article in Deep South Mag that was one of Browning's, I think, as I was researching the Monster Mash episode, and I was like, oh, I want to do an episode about this, so I put it on the schedule right away when this was back in, like, what, October?
Yeah.
So yeah, it was cool to read. I really recommend Browning's work, and he also cites just a plethora of work on modern vampires if you want to read more. Laycock among them.
Yeah, I mean, as long as they're not hurting anyone, I don't see.
Right, like, consent is part, like, of the deal.
Yeah, it's,
like,
very, it's strange to me because it's so rare and I haven't heard of it, but as long as they're not hurting anyone, I don't see why it's
Everybody's trying to do it in a medically sound way.
Yeah.
Browning goes into this thing about, like, defiant type subcultures and, like, sort of the appeal of joining, like, a cultural group because it, like, goes against the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Yeah, it's basically, he's like, we have a lot of baggage about, like, vampires culturally, and so we assume these people are kind of freaks. And, like, it is kind of freaky. Like, Jack was like, this is just kind of like a step towards cannibalism, like, bleh. And I'm like, I mean, right? It's not something I would do. I don't know. I can't really find a huge fault with it other than just that gut reaction of, like, bleh. Right? Like, my initial reaction is like, oh God, that's gross. But it's like, I don't know, whatever. It's not impeding my ability to live my life. They're not like snatching children on the street and, you know, bleeding them dry or anything fucking weird like that. Like a like Dracula probably would.
Ellie, how much money would I need to pay you to drink a shot glass full of someone else's blood? Like, you know who it is. They've been tested. You know all the results. But how much money would you need to have in order to consume a shot glass full of someone else's blood?
A shot glass full?
Yeah, shot glass.
$2,000 at least.
At least $2,000. Wow, she went cheaper than I thought she was going to.
I mean, I've had a nosebleed. I've probably drunk a shot glass worth of blood, say, like, in my life. I've
sucked on a paper cut for forever. Yeah. It would be kind of gross to have that all at once in my mouth, though.
Oh, God, yeah. Like, you'd be like, would it be worse, warm or cold? But, like, if it's cold, it's going to start to coagulate. Oh,
ooh. I know. I'm surprised that you mentioned them blending it with tea, because I would choose something sweeter than tea to blend my blood with. Maybe, like, a Slurpee from 7-Eleven. Like a
milkshake?
Yeah, like a like a Slurpee or, like, a smoothie, maybe. Ugh. It'd be better than tea.
I don't know. I can kind of see it because, like, tea can already have, like,
blood in it? No?
No.
It what are you about to say to me right now?
It can
now?
Sometimes have, like, more, like, savory, earthy, like, notes to it. And so, like, blood might not be as detectable in something that's already kind of earthy tasting, depending on what kind of tea you mix it in. Whereas, like, a milkshake would be like, that's a milkshake that someone had a fucking nosebleed in or some shit, you know?
That's true.
Craig, like, as a tea aficionado, is like, I don't know how to feel about this right now.
I know. I'm like, it doesn't sound great. I think I'd need about the same. Maybe $1,000. You know what? At least how much my rent costs.
Right, so, right. Like, I was like, could I do it for a month of free rent?
Yeah, maybe, I would do it for a month of free barely. Rent. So, like, $1,250.
I would need a little bit. I need, like, rent and, like, a bitchin' jacket, I think. That's why I'm saying $2,000.
Well, your rent is more than me anyway.
Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah. Oh, man. What a wild ride. I saw Modern Vampires on the schedule, and I was like, I have no idea what this means, but I'm coming. It's
exactly what it says on the tin, my good bitch.
Yep. Yep. Now, the question is, do I label this episode with vampires with an I or a Y?
I think with an I. I think the Y is corny. Sorry, vampires with a Y.
It is a little.
It's your prerogative as a vampire, but it's not for me. Vampire. Things that are not for me. Drinking blood, spelling vampire with a Y.
Hello. I also need you to know that the episode after fucking Pusher for X-Files is called Tesa dos Bichos.
Yeah.
Which is like stiff bugs. Two stiff bugs.
Yeah, I don't remember what that one's about.
But it's funny because in some Spanish, bicho means penis.
Huh.
And so saying two stiff penises just made me giggle, and I had to share that with you.
All right. You know what? Now I remember, I've seen that whole season, but I'm like, what the fuck happened in that?
I remember one day I said bicho, like there was a fly in the classroom, and I was like, oh, es un bicho. Está bien. And my Puerto Rican kids were like,
oh, that's the one where they dig up the Ecuadorian dig yes. site.
Yes.
Yep. 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 Ooh. Creepy.
I said ooh because Jack just brought us Thank mojitos, you. Which is very exciting. Cheers, Ellie. Okay. Is that everything? We already did sources. We already did the Patreon. Yep. We had to go.
It was an action-packed, information-filled ride.
It was shorter than what we've been doing for a while, so you're welcome, everybody. Well, look us up on social media besides Patreon. We also have other places you can follow us. I'm going to let Ellie do it because I'm terrible at it.
Messes it up. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and Patreon, Queers for Fears podcast.
Oh, my God, this mojito is so good. Sorry.
We are on Twitter at Queers Fears Pod, and you can Gmail us. Did my voice just... You can Gmail us if you want.
You did sound a little bit like seventh grade boyfriend there for a hot second.
A little pubescent. podcast. Can you imagine? I'm going to be like a fucking firefighter. I'm going to be like, get out of the building, please. Podcastqueersforfears@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Stay queer.
Stay creepy.
Stay consensual with your blood drinking.
Or whatever else you're up to.
Yep. Bye. Bye.